Okay. So what's the deal with that? Can we make any connection between this colorfully worded prose and the class? In particular, I try to give you this stuff there. As I said, you know, everything you read, you should see what you're learning. That's the only way you'll remember anything. In case you want context, here is a kingpin of a crack cocaine ring who essentially is explaining his strategy to somebody as to how to plan for the business. And basically, he's asking this question one day over breakfast. Let's say two guys are offering me a great deal on raw product. I knew enough to know that raw product meant powder cocaine. So one of them says, if I pay 20% higher than the usual rate, he'll give me a 10% discount a year from now, meaning that if the supply goes down, he'll sell to me before the other niggers he deals with. The other guy says he'll give me a 10% discount now if I agree to buy from him at the regular price a year from now. What would you do? Are these goals of achievement or trajectory goals? Are goals about future versus current rewards? What is this stuff? They're trying to figure out how to connect future rewards with current rewards. So they're trying to solve marketization processes. They don't realize it, but that's what they're trying to do. And you thought, you know, drug dealers don't know stuff, but they clearly know. And so this guy tries to give an answer, I guess, somebody like you. Says it all depends on whether you think the supply will be how the supply will be affected a year from now, right? And then this guy says, right, so? Well, I don't have any idea how this market works, so I'm not sure what to do. And this guy explains what you're supposed to do. That's not how you need to think. You always take the sure bet in this game, okay? Nothing can be predicted, not supply, not anything. The guy who tells you that he's going to have the product a year from now is lying. He could be in jail or dead. So take your discount now. So what's gamma? Gamma equal to zero. Okay. I thought, in fact, I was reading this book on the flight. And remember I said when we had the discussion about discounted rewards, we talked about gamma equal to zero versus gamma equal to one. And I mentioned in passing that there is a social scientists have done research which basically points out that in some cases in people essentially just completely ignore any future reward because they don't believe future actually holds for them. Okay? And I said I don't want to go into the actual social science, but here is in fact a book written by a sociologist. This is the book, it turns out, Gang Leader for a Day. This guy, Sudhir Venkatesh, is a, how many of you have read Freakonomics? Okay, so do you remember in the Freakonomics there is actually a story about why do drug dealers live with their moms? Okay, and that's the story about Sudhir Venkatesh. Basically, he was a graduate student who joined sociology department at Chicago and then decided to do research about how urban poverty works in the United States, right? So he went to Robert Taylor Homes, which is one of the public projects. How many of you are from Chicago? Or ever been to Chicago? Okay, so you know public projects in Chicago, and you know that they have now a reasonable, they're sort of separated almost from the mainstream society. At one time it was a great experiment, but it didn't particularly work out. So he went inside and he tried to do actual survey. And then there's this hilarious part where he went with his clipboard apparently to one of these housing projects and asked the following question: how does it feel to be black and poor? And then he provided the following answers: A, very bad; B, somewhat bad; C, neither bad nor good; D, somewhat good; and E, very good. And as he tells it, the right answer happens to be something different. Right. So the interesting thing is he actually made friends with the gang leader called JT, and he then stayed in the drug gang as a grad student. Imagine, you think graduate school is for losers who have no fun. This guy would just go and play, you know, work with the drug gangs. And Sudhir Venkatesh turns out to be a vegetarian, a strict vegetarian. He may or may not drink once in a while, but he somehow stayed with these guys for 10 years, hanging around with JT, and then wrote basically lots and lots of great papers on how, you know, sociology of urban poverty in the United States. And then those of you who read Freakonomics, actually Stephen Levitt is an economist who then worked with him, and he did some work on economics of drug trade. And to point out essentially that while you might think drug trade is very different from everything else, I'm not asking you to do it. I'm just trying to get you to realize that it's just like any other business, and it has a large hierarchy, and there are the top guys, and there are worker ants, and the worker ants hope to try and go up to the top. And part of the reason it makes sense is because everybody, there is nobody who's dumb in this world. Everybody is looking at the world that they have and are trying to optimize with respect to their future. Okay? If you don't think you have a future, then this is what you'll do. You would say, anybody who is telling me that they'll give me something later, ignore that, because that's not going to happen. Okay. Anyway, so I just thought it's actually a very, very well-written book. You know, you're welcome to try and look it up. But it's also the case that things do connect. I mean, we are always doing this idea of discounting future rewards with respect to the current rewards. Okay. And, you know, that's all I have to say on that. Okay. So what I am going to do is to basically do two things in today's class. One is complete like a small part, a shoulder part of the game tree search that we started discussing last time, and then shift to machine learning, which is a huge topic. Just like every other topic, it's a huge topic, and I'll only spend basically two classes, one and a half classes, half of today's class and next class. And I'll also wind up doing it in a slightly different way than the other topics. I'll straight away go into two useful techniques, and then next week explain to you the bigger picture, as against the opposite way. Okay? Normally I explain you the big picture and then give you the techniques, but I want to do it the opposite way, because you'll at least learn the techniques, and you know, then you can think about it before you know, next class. Plus, I can make you do the homework. You know, I can make you do even those questions on the homework. Okay. I mean, the problem with the big picture is, you know, these are all nice fun stuff, I think, but I can't ask questions on this, so you don't have to listen to me. Whereas, you know, an alphabet of pruning, it's a great question, and so you have to learn how to do alphabet of pruning. Talking about that, any questions on anything that we did? How many of you have taken care of listening to the last lecture that I wasn't here, I mean, that I recorded, and some of you didn't make it? Okay. I mean, those of you who are there who got it, otherwise I hope you actually followed it, because today's lecture is a continuation, as I mentioned it to you. Okay. So we were talking last time about min-max search, and in particular a way of doing min-max search fast. And then so if you have min-max search where essentially you expect that your opponent is as rational as you are, in fact perfectly rational, then they will try to not lose the game, and you try to, so they try to win the game, which means, assuming we are looking at zero-sum games, that means only one person wins. If you win, the other person lost. Okay? Then you are trying to maximize, so they are trying to minimize with respect to the same metric. Okay? And in those kinds of scenarios, I pointed out that really you can think of it as a, you know, if you know the values for all the leaf nodes, if you do min-max propagation, then you can tell which direction to go. Okay? And then you do that actual step, and then let the opponent make a move. And if the opponent winds up making a move, you know, they do the same sort of analysis, hopefully. And then you make your move. Okay? And the quality of your move depends upon whether or not, in fact, if in fact you are two omniscient agents, right? One of the interesting things is the following thing. How many of you remember the idea of deterministic snakes and ladders? No dice, you know, play snakes and ladders without dice. Okay, you might think that's a completely stupid game. You know, there's nothing to do. You know, essentially, if you have no dice, then you can always just go find a ladder and go up, right? Of course, that only requires that you have eyes. Okay, now somehow we think deterministic snakes and ladder is a dumb game, but chess is a non-dumb game. How do you think chess would be between two omniscient agents, two completely rational agents, who have complete computational power to actually go down such that every leaf node is actually is in fact a terminating node? That means it's either a definite win, definite loss, or a definite draw, and the world agrees on this. If you do that, then is there any point in playing chess game? Okay, so don't expect, you know, don't hope for omniscient, complete computational power, because you lose fun. Remember, you used to like tic-tac-toe. Some of you probably still like it, you know. but those of you who like tic-tac-toe at one time and don't like it as much now, it's because, in fact, you can say it's a loss. You know, we used to take pleasures in these, you know, brain-dead games like tic-tac-toe. Now our brain improved, and so we don't need it anymore. Now, if your brain becomes so big that you actually can do min-max search all the way to the leaf nodes, chess too is gone. You can't take any pleasure in it. I mean, not that some of you probably already don't take any pleasure in chess, but those of you currently take pleasure, you lose the pleasure the moment you know. Because chess is a deterministic game. And if I can go all the way down and my opponent can go all the way down, then what the heck is the point? You may as well not play. You know, if this sort of reminds me of the beginning portion of, what's that book? Hitchhiker's Guide to Galaxy. Where, remember, this guy says, since you know that he would be sleeping there, you know, stop the truck from, you know, demolishing the house, and you want to do your job in trying to do this, once we figure out both of us are going to do it, we don't actually have to do it. So this guy takes the guy to a bar and then says, you know, you just, you know, hold the place. So it might look funny, but in essence, you know, that's sort of what happens in this case. If you have infinite computational power, there's no point in playing chess. Okay, which makes me which gets us to the point. Well, of course, even if you did have infinite computational power, you can talk about essentially doing faster reasoning, which is why alpha beta pruning still makes sense. If you decided to play the game, you can either do it essentially, you know, in the normal way by looking at the whole thing and do the min max search in the breadth first way, which in essence, space-wise, it will wind up keeping the entire game tree in the memory and then get you which particular move to make. Or you can do it in a depth-first way, which will still give the same answer. Remember, depth-first and breadth-first in this particular case will give the same answer because A, it's a finite depth tree, okay, and B, all you're doing is at each level you're actually taking mins and maxes. Okay, so we talked about alpha beta pruning, which is an improvement over depth first search, which stops search in some direction. Okay, I also, apart from talking about one alpha beta pruning example in the class, I also recorded a video, quote unquote video, of another alpha beta pruning. I think, so this was a thing I talked last time, I won't go into it again. I also did this. I recorded a video for how to do this one. So you can do it yourself and you can see whether the way alpha beta pruning works according to you is the way it works according to me. Okay? And then, so this all can make sense irrespective of, you know, even if in fact all of these are leaf nodes. But as I was pointing out, also I pointed out last time that at the best case alpha beta pruning, at the very best case, alpha beta pruning tree would look like this. So don't be too greedy. Don't think that alpha beta pruning, in the best case, A star search tree looks like what? Goes directly to the solution. So there is a temptation that, well, alpha beta pruning looks like a great idea, so in the best case, it should go directly to whatever is the actual node. But you don't know that. Instead, what you're essentially doing is, if in fact the tree is oriented in such a way that both the mins and maxes moves are always ordered best to last, left to right. Okay? If you do it that way, then in essence, the pruning will happen, the maximum amount of pruning will happen, and then the tree will look like this. Okay? And then I argued, in fact, if you read this, you will realize that essentially what is happening is this tree, which should have had B power D nodes, assuming B is the branching factor and D is the depth, it should have had B power D nodes at the bottom. But it really winds up only having approximately 2 times B power D by 2 nodes. So of the order of B power D by 2 nodes instead of the order of B power D nodes, which is a huge reduction. So in effect, what it means is, in the best case, alpha beta pruning makes the search think that the effective branching factor is really only, you can do it as, you can, B power D by 2 can be written in multiple ways, right? So you can think of B power D by 2 as square root of B power D, right? And so in effect, when you do alpha beta pruning, even though the tree has branching factor B, the search feels as if the tree only has branching factor square root of B. Okay? Another way of looking at it is that if you, I had, let's say, you know, 1 hour previously, and I was able to go some depth. Now, in the same amount of time, I can go double the depth. Right? Instead of, basically, I would be done, so I'm actually able to effectively increase the depth of my search for the same amount of time. Okay, so keep that in mind. It all looks as if it's not a big deal in terms of depth. It doesn't look like, if you really do have infinite computational power, who are you trying to impress in terms of getting done fast? You anyway have a very boring life ahead of you, so it doesn't really matter whether you get done fast or not. Okay, but, so we will now start talking about the other aspect that, so first of all, properties of InMax, it is complete if the tree is finite. Okay, and it is optimal against optimal opponent, in the sense, as I said, if in fact all you are trying to optimize is not to lose, then min-max is your best strategy. And remember, the classic way of saying min-max is a bad strategy is anybody who thinks too much when they are playing chess with their 2-year-old nephew or niece, you know, obviously didn't understand what's the point of the game. Okay, unless this 2-year-old nephew or niece came from some alien land and knows, you know, too much already, you know, this, you should not be wasting your time trying to go, you know, and figure out what's the best move, because these kids are probably not going to be able to tell anyway one piece from the other. Okay, I mean, as to why you are playing with your 2-year-old nephew or niece is a different story. But if you are, you shouldn't. This is clearly not the optimal strategy. Okay. And then complexity, prime complexity is B power M. If you do alpha, beta, it basically essentially can cut down the branching factor to square root. And so you can do the same amount of work in, double the work in the same amount of time. Okay. And as I said, alpha, beta only makes sense. I mean, the best case of alpha, beta only happens if in fact the tree was structured in such a way that, you know, unbeknownst to you, the tree was structured in such a way that your best moves, the max's best moves are left to right, and min's best moves are also left to right. If that wasn't the case, then you would do less savings. In the worst case, alpha beta pruning will do just as many expansions as normal min-max. In the best case, it does B power do. I mean, it basically, you know, does much better. Okay. And, you know, as long as you do depth-first search, space complexity is only BM. And you should not even consider doing anything other than depth-first search for this. Okay? You know, if I ask you, why don't you do depth-first search, you should say, why should I do it? Okay? Now, for chess, for chess, it turns out, essentially, that the branching factor is approximately 35. And anything I say about chess, take it with a large pinch of salt. Okay, I would be the guy who loses with a 2-year-old kid in the chess, right? Even if I think ahead. So, but you know, chess is something that several of you know. So I'm sort of, you know, giving you the information that, you know, that is apparently true. That, you know, effectively the branching factor for chess is about 35. Okay, and then the number of moves for a reasonable game before the game terminates is about 100, which means 50 moves by each person playing the game. Okay, and so you are talking about a tree of 35 power 100. If you do alpha beta pruning, then you may be able to get by, and in the perfect case you may be able to get by with 35 power 50, which unfortunately is still too darn bad. Okay, so the question is and basically you don't have infinite computational power, so what do you do? You cannot actually go all the way down to terminal nodes. By the way, one of the interesting things is m equal to 100 for reasonable games. It's essentially only saying by about 100 moves between reasonable people, right, you would have reached the nodes which are terminal. Okay, but that doesn't necessarily mean that there is no branch in chess which beyond 100 will be a terminal, I mean, will have to be a terminal node. I mean, that doesn't necessarily mean that every branch in the chess game must become a terminal node by depth 100. That's not true. It's just that typically they become a terminal node by depth 100. Some of them might go much deeper, becoming terminal. Okay. So basic idea is that we have no real hope of going all the way to terminal nodes. What can you go terminal nodes for? Tic-tac-toe. That you can do with the current technology. Okay. Chess, you still cannot go. Okay. And so you need to go, what do you do at that point of time? Essentially what I gotten into this, remember I gotten into this from MDP, real-time dynamic programming. There too, every branch could have been pushed until every node becomes every leaf node becomes a terminal node. That means it's a sink node. There is no transition out of it. Once you get there, you can't come out. Right? In such a case, RTDP approach would have told you exactly the optimal action to do from the current state. Okay? But if in fact you don't have time to expand the tree such that every leaf node becomes a terminal node, then what did I say? I said, well, leave it, go as far as you can and leave that leaf nodes, and then give those leaf nodes an estimated value. An estimated value. If in fact they were sink nodes, then their immediate reward is their real value. That's the only thing you'll ever get. If on the other hand, they are not sink nodes, then you can take their immediate reward, that's only an estimate. Or you could do some sort of a heuristic, which tells you essentially what would have been the expected, what would be the estimate of the final value of that node. Okay? In fact, I would also argue that in the RTDP, it's not required that every node be thrown all the way down to sink level. Okay? If every node at the leaf node, if you know its maximum, its optimal value, remember when we talked about MDP, we talked about optimal value for each state. If you know the optimal value, then you know the optimal policy. Suppose I happen to know the optimal value for all the leaf nodes, then just backing it up, I'll know what exactly is the optimal thing to do from the current state. Okay. Eventually, all I'm arguing is you don't need to go all the way to the final depth. If you stop in the middle, have an estimate of how good the board position is for the game. Okay. So when you don't have full computational power, you have to cut it off. You cut off the search somewhere and then give an evaluation to each of the leaf nodes. In the case of MDP, that evaluation is estimating the final value of that node. Okay. In the case of game trees too, it is estimating the final probability of you winning from that board position. So how good is this board position from the max's point of view? If it's already a terminal node, it's plus infinity. I mean, if it's already a terminal node and the max is going to win from here, then it's plus infinity. If it is already a terminal node and max is going to lose, it's minus infinity. If it's a definite draw, it's zero. Numbers in between are basically you are estimating that it's more likely to lose, more likely to win, etc. Okay? So these evaluation functions are essentially the estimates, heuristic estimators for the leaf nodes. Okay? So if I am doing tic-tac-toe, so let's, as far as the cutoff test is concerned, let's first assume a simplistic idea. Up front, I'll assume I'll go 10 deep. That's it. 10 deep means one of my move, one of my opponent move, one of my move, one of my opponent move, and I go 10 ply. Okay? And I'll get a nice big tree of depth 10, uniform tree of depth 10. Okay? That's where we'll assume we start. And then, of course, there are leaf nodes, some of which are already definitely wins and definitely losses, but some of which are just intermediate game position. Right? Okay, so the question then is, how do you give them values? Okay, here is an example for tic-tac-toe, which is a game that you probably know. If I basically have a normal a leaf node, then basically I would say, if it's a definite win for max, then I would say it's plus infinity, or a big number plus. Okay, if it's a definite loss for max, then it's minus infinity or a big negative number. If it's a draw for max, you'll say zero. Otherwise, then I will give this as my approximate estimate, which is number of rows, columns, diagonals still open for max. I'm assuming you remember what tic-tac-toe is. You're trying to put crosses and circles, and you want to control something. Okay. Basically, from the max's point of view, the number of rows, columns, and diagonals open for max minus number of rows, columns, and diagonals open to the min. It's a reasonable heuristic. It's sort of like straight line distance heuristic. Okay? So that's your evaluation function. Okay? A reasonable one. You could come up with other ones. Okay? And if I do this, one important thing, of course, is notice that I could have applied this even to game positions that are already terminal. And this will never give plus infinity and minus infinity. But I don't do it. I actually do it in this way. If it is a known terminal position and it's a win, I give it plus infinity. If it's a known terminal and it's a loss, I'll give minus infinity. If it's a known draw, I'll give it a zero. And if I can't tell, then I'll use this. Remember that. That's very important. Okay? So, for example, in the case of, let's say, MDPs, right, I could do the following thing for MDP version. Switching back and forth between MDPs and game trees because I want you to think that they're really the same. It's just a question of how you backup. In one case, you do expected backup. The other case, you do min-max backup. Okay. So in the MDPs, let's say there are leaf nodes, and this is a definite sink node. Okay. Anything which is sink node, I'll put a circle. And this is a definite sink node with -2 value. And so its immediate reward is -2. That means its real value is -2. And this one is again a definite sink node with plus 4, so it'll get plus 4 as a value. And everything else, assume this is some sort of a grid scenario, the kind of MDP problem we looked at, I can just take straight line distance from this node to the nearest goal node and say that's the value. Do you understand what I'm saying? So if there are no obstacles, that will actually become the value. But you could have done this for this too, but you won't do it because you know here much better that it's already a sink node, so there's no point in estimating. I know the real value. Okay? And when you don't know, you use the heuristic. If you do that, you know, if you were in the chess, then obviously I'm out of my depth, but essentially, you know, the usual kinds of evaluation functions that people might use, like Deep Blue users, for example, would be some sort of a linear weighted sum of features of the board, where these features, okay, these features could be, first feature could be number of white queens minus number of black queens. And those of you who know chess, you know, that number only is 1 and 0, right? You know, you can't have too many queens. But that's okay. So if you have 1 and the other guy has 0, it's 1. And if you have 0 and the other guy has 1, then this value is -1. If you have 1 and they have 1, it cancels out. If you have 0 and they have 0, it cancels out. That's what it's doing. Okay, that's just one thing. And you can also, people can come up with, you know, control of the center, a feature called control of the center, which would basically be, again, constructed from the board positions. And then you decide some weight for this. Okay? Right? Now, so these are the evaluation functions. Okay, keep in the back of your head who is coming up with these evaluation functions, because that will let it That would be today's segue into learning. Okay, there are many, many different ways of segueing into learning, but that would be today's segue into learning. Okay, but let's assume that's given to us. Okay, then all I need to do is I cut off the search at some level, I apply the evaluation function for the leaf nodes, and then I do backup using min-max, using alpha beta. Yes, sir. So basically at this point, that's a very good point, but right now I said cut everywhere at the same level. So I upfront decided I'm not going to go more than 10 levels deep in any level. So I stop exactly at the 10th level everywhere. I'll get back to your question in a minute, okay, because that's a slightly better idea than just saying everywhere you should go to the same depth. Okay, now, so if I do this, right, and essentially this, my friends, is the state of the art in game trees, epsilon away from the state of the art in game trees. So if you want to understand how did Deep Blue beat Garry Kasparov, who currently is in the news, by the way, has any of you been following Garry Kasparov? Apparently is running for a political office in Russia, and recently he did this very interesting thing. New York Times had an article. Because he has no real future in chess, you see, because computers have taken over. so we drove him to politics, you know, so that's the reason. But he's actually, you know, playing, he's essentially, you know, helping a third party or the second party in Soviet Union. There was a recent story, I think, last week, where a particular mayor who was going to win, you know, the mayorship anyway, in Russia you win because they tell people, you know, I think there was this whole joke, at least in Soviet Union, that, you know, if you want to vote for the government, you vote here. If you want to vote against the government, go into this other room and vote. And there would be KGB there. Anyway, so it hasn't yet changed too much. And so there was this mayor guy who was going to win, and he didn't want to unnecessarily get involved in actual speeches where people ask him questions, etc. But finally, somehow, Garry Kasparov, using his chess brilliance, you know, made up this situation where he came to give a speech in one place where Kasparov was also in the audience. And then he used asking a question as a ruse to take over the stage and talk for about an hour or something. Not that it made any difference, I think. You know, that other guy won still, because I think the election was done before the votes were cast. So Kasparov is still alive and kicking. He's not playing, you know, chess as much, I think. But, you know, Deep Blue, which beat Kasparov, more or less used this idea. You know, basically, finite depth search followed by, you know, evaluating the nodes at the leaf level, then do min-max backup using alpha beta pruning. So you can write Deep Blue now, essentially. Okay? Now here's the interesting thing. What makes the difference? So now that, you know, you put yourself in the shoes of the people who did Deep Blue, you know, and they were trying to figure out, actually they first tried to play with Kasparov a couple of times. Kasparov is a nice guy. He actually, you know, allowed people to play against, machines to play against him. And while other people were coming up with lame objections as to why they're too high and mighty to even play with a machine. And so they were wondering, first time around obviously they lost with Kasparov, and they're trying to figure out where do they put their money, you know, before the next match. The big IBM is trying to figure out, should we buy raw computational power so that we can go deeper, okay, and then evaluate the nodes at the deeper level, or should we spend our time on the evaluation function? You know, come up with much smarter evaluation functions. Keep the depth the same, come up with much smarter evaluation functions. What do you think humans will say when you ask Kasparov, how do you win the game? What do you think he says? Does he say, I go deeper and deeper than other people? That makes him look like a bozo. So he says, no, I actually see patterns. You know, the God tells me, the chess God tells me what is the right thing to do, which is, you know, unfortunately, introspection is the worst form of psychology. Right, you know, if you ask people who do well in something, why do you do well in that, don't even waste your time taking down the answer, because they have no clue why they do well. Right, So it may be or it may not be the case that actually Kasparov looks at patterns in the board. That's what at least he says. Okay. Now, they did in the beginning spend a lot of time trying to improve the evaluation functions. You know, for example, either hand code better evaluation functions, pay all these ill-paid grandmasters money so that they'll make up features so that you can make better and better evaluation functions for the game. And then on the other side, they said, you know, to heck with it, let's buy bigger CPUs and go brute force deeper. What do you think worked in the end? Second thing, going deeper, brute force, unfortunately, it's really depressing because it feels as if you shouldn't be doing computer science at all. You know, just get a bigger computer. And, you know, you don't even need to know sorting, right? I mean, if you have a big enough computer, you can do exponential time sorting. Nobody will know any difference, right? Right? So anyway, it actually works. So it turns out that the way chess works, the first big breakthroughs happened because they were able to get faster machines. In fact, you know, IBM being IBM said we will design a VLSI chip, which is specifically with only aim in life is to generate, you know, chess moves. I mean, basically it can generate these chess trees much faster. You have to write a Lisp program. You know, they just have a VLSI chip that whose only purpose in life is to, you know, generate chess trees faster. Okay? And they won. Well, it did tell us that humans should not be trusted, right? right? You know, it doesn't matter. So, for example, if you ask birds, right, you know, how are you able to fly? And they would say, you know, we flap in a reasonably graceful way. And have you seen any plane that flaps in a reasonably graceful way and actually still flies? If we waited for that kind of a plane, we won't be flying, right? It may well be that there is a way of doing it by looking at the patterns. I'm not necessarily discounting it. Okay, but if we could have been waiting for patterns in the chessboard, and we may never have really gotten to grandmaster level. I mean, in terms of, you know, now we know that chess is a boring game. We can do something else. You know, basically we know, for example, weightlifting is a boring game, right? Because cranes can do much better, right? And so is chess. So there are, you know, in fact, as we understand more and more, we will become less and less interested in life. You know, that's unfortunate reality. Okay, so you know, you have to remember that you have lost the interest that you used to have in tic-tac-toe. That's a loss of innocence. Okay, anyway, so why is deeper better? So I just told you that deeper is better. You know, why is going deeper and using the same random evaluation function better? You have to ask yourself. The difference between computer scientists and people who just want to win games is computer scientists basically will ask this question. Why is it better? Okay, here are some answers. One possible answer is taking mins and maxes of the evaluation values on the leaf nodes and then combining them to get to the top node improves the evaluation value of the top node. So imagine what you're saying. What you're saying is I have the same heuristic function. I could have applied it right here. Instead, I'll go all the way down, apply it here, and then I'll combine it in the mins and maxes. Somehow the mins and maxes do the magic. So the accuracy of my really bad evaluation function improves just because I did it here rather than here. That's one possibility. In fact, I think a lot of you might be thinking that's the possibility. Okay? The other possibility is going deeper. So it turns out that that is actually totally bogus. Okay, if you want to estimate a quantity, let's say, which is a statistical average of huge number of other quantities, right, you should not be wasting your time estimating those other quantities and taking the average. You should be directly estimating that quantity that you're trying to estimate. Okay, that's like a cardinal rule in statistics that error can only increase, it doesn't reduce. Okay, so in general, when you use your same old bad evaluation function at the lower level and combine it to go up, you should have effectively increased the error in your evaluation function or worsened its accuracy. And yet, I'm telling you that in reality, you're doing better. Why? In fact, it turns out that, so the other possibility is, remember, I spent a lot of time explaining to you that you just don't do this for every state. You do it this way. If you know that the state is a definite win or a definite loss, you will not be using the heuristic. You will know the exact value for them. And only when you don't know the exact value would you use this. Now, when do you think this kind of thing is happening in a game? Sometimes in a game, even though there are paths that can go very far down, there are also paths that will get you into a trap. Which is why when you try to play with the grandmaster while drinking a coffee will make a couple of moves and you lost it already. You would be saying, no, I'm supposed, I was told that there is at least 100 moves in this game. How come I'm done already? And they'll say, you know, you have no clue. There are traps all over the place and you thought, my God, I have this great move, and then they put you in a trap. The interesting point is if you look at a trap, right, you should be able to recognize it. It's just basically you're looking at the current board and you did not simulate it far enough to see the trap that's right there, you know, around the bend. If you have traps in the search space, and think of traps as basically states whose value is directly known. Either it's positive or negative, but you know it directly. Those are direct sync nodes. If there are such nodes in the search space, even a small percentage of them are there, then going deeper basically increases the effective accuracy at the top level. Do you understand what I'm saying? So in essence, what I'm saying is it's a weird property of the game of chess as well as some of the other games you play that they have to win the game, you probably have to play, you know, between two reasonable people, to win the game, you probably have to play about 100 moves. But to lose it, right, with the grandmaster, you can be done in like 3-4 moves if you miss the traps. And it's that the analysis is trying to stop. So basically by looking ahead, you are able to see the traps, and then when there are traps, you are actually getting completely accurate values of the leaf nodes. And then you are getting some inaccurate values and you are combining them, and there are really two effects that are going on when you're doing min-max. One is when you combine them, you lose accuracy. The other is by going down, you saw the trap, so you know actual value of that node. Okay? And this wins when they both fight. And that's why going deeper winds up being right. Now, how do you prove that this is true? You can prove it by making up a game where there are no traps. Now, obviously, we have no such games because, you know, if they were there, then people never played and so they got forgotten. But computer scientists have no other work to do, so they can make games. Okay? A guy called Dana Now, who used to be my professor back in Maryland, his thesis work was on game tree pathology. And he essentially pointed out that you can make games, artificial games, where there are no traps, and going deeper worsens the quality of your play. Exactly how you expect. But as you increase the number of traps in this synthetic game, the accuracy improves. The real chess happens to be already such that it has, you know, these traps strewn all over the place, and so accuracy does improve with them. Who is the guy who did this analysis? It turns out, I mean, Dana Now was one of the guys, but another person who actually did this analysis about traps is a person by name Hoodia Pearl. And if you heard his name multiple times in this class, it's not a surprise. You heard it last time when? Bayes Network. And he also did a lot of work in single agent A-star search stuff. And he did a lot of work on this too. Okay? But again, this is one of the kind of questions that distinguishes a programmer from a computer scientist. Please understand that. Okay? Anybody can hack. My son can hack. Right? You have to ask at the end of the day, you know, why is something working? You know, if your day-to-day work for the next day may or may not be affected, but your overall understanding of why things are working and how to get the next better idea very much depends on asking these kinds of questions. Okay? So that's something that you want to understand. Okay. So, as I already said, that since I wasn't going to say, let's see if I have, there was a question that this guy asked, so because of which I probably have to point out something that I already removed. Let me see, no. Nah, okay. No. Okay, no. So I don't have the slide here. I think I removed it. But in essence, even though I said you can go uniformly deep in every branch, you can actually start being smarter and say, why should I go uniformly deep in every branch? I don't get any badge for that, right? So I might want to go deeper in some branches and shallower in some other branches. Okay? You clearly already know that in any branch you already hit a terminal node, you are not going to go any deeper. Makes no sense, right? If in fact you got a trap right at the seventh level, there is no point in going from 7th to 100th level, because the trap is a trap. Just like a constraint satisfaction problem, once there is a failure, you're dead. So you already know that you are stopping in some branches faster. The question is, can I also extend it and say, my default value is, let's say, 10th life. But in some cases, I want to go deeper. Some cases, obviously, I will stop faster because of the traps. Okay, it turns out that's a much better idea. In fact, you can go deeper in some areas than others. Before I point that out, let me point this part, which is very impressive for, I think, chess. Okay, in terms of look ahead, if you do 4-ply look ahead, that means 4 moves ahead, then you get a hopeless chess player, like mine, like me. Okay, basically that's like human novice. If you do 8-ply. And the time this was written, about, you know, I guess 1998 time frame, 8-ply is a typical PC and a human master. That's approximately what they're able to do. Okay, and a 12-ply is Deep Blue and Kasparov. We are not talking huge depths. We are not talking 100 moves ahead. You can't do 100 moves ahead. To be able to do 12-ply versus 8-ply is the difference between a typical human user and grandmaster level chess. So being able to go deeper in the same time is a huge, big boost. Alpha beta pruning will give you that. And furthermore, going deeper in some directions can be a better idea. Now the question, of course, is which directions do you go deeper? So obviously, I can say the following thing. I can say go deeper in those directions where you are supposed to go deeper, right? But it doesn't work that way. So instead, what I could do is keep track of, I have an evaluation function, right? Which I understand is sort of iffy. It's not correct. That's why I'm going deeper. But that's what I'm going to use, right? So what I could do is I could use this evaluation function f to decide whether or not a particular line of play has reached quiescence. Okay, the word quiescence, that means it's become quiet, not much is happening there. Okay, how do you decide that? So I am come to a particular level node, right? And then I, let's say, f of a is 4. And I go and I went one more deep. And then before going further down, I just know the values here using f. So I do a min-max and I will get f1 of a is still 4, let's say. In which case, going ahead one level didn't change the value of A. Whereas, if it became minus 4, that means on this line of play, looks like evaluation is changing quite quickly. So this is not a time to stop. Let me go until things quieten down and then stop. Okay, so in essence, what you would do is for every, you know, node, you have the history of the backed up values for that node, which is cheap, which is extremely cheap. And if the history of backed up value is sort of not changing too much, then you can say, I'll stop that line of search. If it is changing too much, then I go deeper. Do you understand this? Okay. Now I'm making the decision based on the past, not on the future. Okay. This will never really be able to stop traps from, you know, looking just behind the horizon. Okay, so this idea of quiescent search is to use the past to figure out how far to go. So it's like saying, you know, nothing is happening in the last 5 days, so I would stop looking at this building. Nobody is going to rob this building. That doesn't necessarily mean that, you know, right after you stop, they won't rob the building. But if on the other hand, if this building is being robbed every day, hoping that I can take off a day on vacation, nobody will do anything next day, is silly. Because you already thought, based on the past, things that are happening. Okay? So that's the idea of quiescent search, and you use the evaluation function to figure out how deep to go. Another use for the evaluation function is, remember I said alpha beta pruning is effective only if the moves in the tree are arranged from the best to worst. The best to worst order depends on the full tree. If you know the full tree, then you can rearrange it. But now you need to heuristically rearrange it. So what I can do is, I'll take the same F value, and at the max level, look at the child nodes in the order of decreasing F values. And in the min level, look at the children in the order of increasing F values. So to the extent you believe that your evaluation function is reasonable, you should do this.
That would be linear, right?
What? Yeah, it doesn't change the complexity. I'm just saying that rather than just live with the order that you are given, which is a random order, you can order it with respect to evaluation function, which will hopefully, if the evaluation function is perfect, then it would give you the perfect alpha beta ordering. Okay? If not, you will be back no worse off than the previous one, which is any random ordering. I understand, but the thing is, you don't do it, your life would be pretty non-trivially affected, okay? In the sense that it's a trivial idea to implement, is what you are saying, but it can have non-trivial effect on the efficiency, which is what you pay money to become a computer scientist to learn about, okay? Just, you know, you don't have to work for 10 days to get a great idea, and the great idea doesn't have to be 10 pages long, okay? Anybody can say, after the idea is explained, after the idea has been found by somebody else, that looks like trivial. Why didn't I think about it? That's the beauty of great ideas. Sometimes, you know, and this I don't think is such a great idea, but in fact, we are on the lookout for easy to implement ideas which would have huge impact on the performance. So that's exactly what you're looking for. Okay, don't look for complex ideas just because you want, you know, papers, right? I mean, you want simple ideas which make miracles. And this is a very simple idea, and it works very well in practice. Okay, so that is the other thing. And since I also said this, there is another point I should mention, which is horizon effect. I mentioned this horizon effect, which is, as I said, just because in the last 4 days nothing happened in this building doesn't mean tomorrow nothing is going to happen. It's just more probable. But if on the other hand, I'm in an adversarial scenario, it's not benign nature, I'm in an adversarial scenario, I could assume that the reason nothing happened here is because the guy who wanted to rob this room was waiting until I leave. And for 4 days I'll hang around and see nothing is happening and I leave, then she will come in and rob the place. Right? Okay? So in an adversarial scenario, you can't assume that the past is a predictor of future, because the adversary has brains too. So a classic effect of this is, in fact, in the book they talk about this too, is how Allies handled Hitler during Second World War. Right? Looks like Hitler is, you know, how do you tell whether Hitler is any worse off than any tin pot dictator? He just wanted Poland. Give the poor guy a Poland, he'll stop after that. Let's give him a Poland, okay? Then this year he just wants Czechoslovakia, and we have elections and people don't want us to spend too much money on wars, so let's give him Czechoslovakia too. Now the interesting thing is, as long as Hitler knows, I mean, this is in fact, you know, this is something that, you know, remember I think McCain said in the last election cycle, getting a deadline to get out of Iraq, you know, without telling you what my ideas are as to whether it was a good idea to get into Iraq or not, putting a public deadline and telling everybody, after this day we'll be out of Iraq, is like saying publicly, I am checking this room for next 4 days, and the fourth day I will leave this room. So all the adversary has to do is hang around in the coffee house for 4 days, and as soon as I leave, come in and rob the place. Do you understand what I'm saying? Because adversaries have brains, no worse than yours. Okay, so any finite depth search has this problem that you have the temptation to push the inevitable right across the horizon. All the presidents have it. Just make sure that the economy doesn't collapse before I leave. The poor Bush didn't get it. Okay, Reagan did get it. Reagan went out at a hail of glory. Right after he left, the damn thing fell apart. Right? And so we still want Reagan to be on, you know, Rushmore, Mount Rushmore, and, you know, people don't necessarily seem to have the same level of respect for Bush. Okay? But the point is, it's all fixed depth search, and all you need to do is push it beyond the horizon. That may or may not be the optimally right thing to do. But there is no obvious way of solving the horizon effect. Okay, and allies basically kept doing this until half of the Europe has disappeared, and then they said, hey, why not just go for a war? And that's when they did it. Okay, so that's the interesting point about fixed depth search in adversarial scenario, because if they know where you are, then essentially I can keep pushing the inevitable failure just a few levels deeper than where you look from. Quiescence effect tries to capture it to some extent, but it cannot be completely sure. So you should never tell your opponent, I'm a four-ply kind of a guy. Okay? You tell them, then they'll put all the traps waiting for you at the fifth level, and you'll miss all of them. Okay? Questions? Okay. So, I mentioned that we have evaluation functions. Okay. Let's see, where am I? Give me a second, I'm just trying to look at this. So I mentioned that we have this evaluation function that we have to learn, and that we need, and we assume somebody will give it to us, or humans will make it up. Okay, that's not the only time we did this in this course. Okay, every piece of knowledge about the world we assumed was written by somebody into the knowledge base. Okay, one question, of course, is perhaps it would be good if your computational agent learned some of this knowledge by itself from experience. Okay, now if that is the case, now of course if it's knowledge that I can easily give you, I mean the human programmer can easily give the machine, then it's no point in learning it by itself. If on the other hand, it's not an easy knowledge to give, and there are not enough people trying to write it down, it may be worthwhile to try to learn it from experience. Okay, so from the point of view of this course, learning is obviously one way the knowledge for your knowledge-based agent comes from. Now, what kinds of knowledge is it? How does the environment evolve? What kind of effect does my actions have on the environment? Okay, these are the kinds of knowledge that you need. And I assume that was provided to us in some representation as logical or base networks or something. In all the cases, I assume I just gave it. Okay, and the programmer gave it. So what we will start looking, starting today, and I guess basically the next class, really, is to see what can be done to learn some of this. Now, again, I think this particular semester has been crazy. Normally, I spend about 3 classes on learning chapters. Okay, it's a big topic, just as every other topic. But we only have 1.5 classes, 1.10 classes. So what I'm mostly going to try and do is give you a very partial view, okay? I feel okay about this because if there are other courses that you can take to learn some of the material in AI. In fact, for machine learning, there are more options than for some of the other things. Okay, you can try and take, for example, data mining course, which would tell you a couple of the ideas I'll tell you here, for example. Okay, this is not to say that machine learning is not important. As I said, you know, it's very useful to be able to learn the knowledge instead of being dependent on the humans. But I just ran out of time. And I think if I have to give up on something, I would rather give up on this because somebody else can catch that slack. You can take a course. At undergraduate level, you couldn't have taken a course to learn about Markov addition processes, for example. Okay, I think that's just as important. Okay, so the idea is to try and learn the evaluation function, let's say, as an example. Now, how might you have learned the evaluation function? One thing, one possibility is, suppose you didn't know anything about chess, okay? So you have, let's say, a board position, and you describe that board position in terms of some features, feature one, feature two, etc. And then you basically played from this board position. You learned whether you won or lost. And then if you lost, then you say, if you came from here, you lose. And if you came from another board, you win. Okay, I'm just making the evaluation function be 0, 1 right now. But if in fact the wins and losses have numbers, then you can actually say, for this board, the eventual outcome is this much. For this board, the eventual outcome is this much. So I have a bunch of training examples. Okay? I have a bunch of training examples, and what I'm trying to do is to learn from that training examples some general rule about what features of chess board seem to make it a winning position versus a losing position. Right? You clearly know that if this exact board comes up again, probably it's going to be again a loss or a win. Okay, but the question is, if you see a new position, can you generalize what you learned from these examples to classify and say, this will be a win, this will be a loss? This particular kind of learning is one type of learning, a very simple type of learning, and it's called classification learning. Okay, it's a very simple kind of learning, and all I'm assuming is that I have a set of examples. Okay, here I have a set of examples. Now this is a weird set of examples. These, instead of being evaluation values of boards, this is a different set of examples. This is Russell, who is the textbook writer for your textbook. He decided that this basically, he tried to summarize his restaurant waiting habits. Okay, so every time he went to a restaurant, he basically classified it in terms of some features. Okay, what is there a bar? Is there an alternative to that particular restaurant? Is it a Friday? Are there any patrons in the restaurant? What is the price range of the restaurant, etc., etc.? And then how much is the estimated wait? And then on that day, did he or did he not wait to be seated? You have this problem, right? Sometimes you go to a restaurant, and you know, especially if you ever go to Olive Garden, the answer is leave, because you always have to have 45 minutes wait, unless you have my son, in which case you wait for 3 days, you know, until you get seated. Okay, so there are various levels of wait, and some people give up faster than others. Okay, if Olive Garden is the only thing you want to do, then basically for my son, if Olive Garden, wait. If not, do whatever. Right? It's a simple rule for him. Okay? But for Russell, maybe it's a more complex rule. So a question is, if you have nothing better to do than to predict whether or not Russell is likely to wait in a restaurant, then you have a bunch of training examples. Okay? Sometimes he waited, sometimes he didn't wait. From this, you are trying to figure out whether he would wait in a new scenario. And you want to predict that. Okay? Now, yes, this could be, for example, instead of Russell waiting, it could be, for example, the evaluation. So, feature one, the board control, the number of queens, the number of pawns, won the game, lost the game. And then you're trying to figure out, given the features of the game, are you going to win the game or not? Board, are you going to win or lose the game? And if you are much more down to earth, you might say the squeakiness of the voice of the caller and the amount of money they seem to have spent on, let's say, cigarettes, and whether or not the original owner of this credit card ever spent money on cigarettes, and is this a fraudulent transaction or not? Credit card companies are all the time trying to figure out whether there's a fraudulent transaction or not. Right? Okay. So, although I look at Russell, it's not that I'm like crazy about Russell. It's just this is a good enough example. Okay? And if you understand how to classify that, you can classify it in other classes too. So the question is, how do you do this? The basic idea is, of course, you need to decide how to represent your knowledge. Okay? If you did learn the knowledge, then how would you represent the knowledge? So suppose here is Russell training example. Suppose you figured out a pattern. How would you represent that pattern? You would use one of the representations you learned in the class. You could represent it using logical rules, right? So for example, we will talk about an idea called decision tree, which is essentially a propositional logical formula. Okay? So if you learn a decision tree from this set of examples, and if you never heard about decision tree is asking 20 questions to figure out the answer. And the game in 20 questions is to ask the most relevant questions up front. Like, how are you doing is a wasted question, right? Because everybody says fine, and it's not going to give you any useful information. So you want to ask the questions that are most likely to get you to the classification of this training examples. And then those questions will then be asked for the test examples too. Test is your rest of your life. Okay? So you could learn logical formulas, and that would be decision tree learning. You could learn Bayesian networks. Okay? So basically I could have a Bayes network whose top is Russell Weights, and then a whole bunch of evidence which is either bottom level evidence or intermediate level evidence. Okay? And then if I need a Bayes network, then what do I need? I need the structure of the network, right? And I need what else? If this is the structure, then I need CPTs for each of the nodes. So here CPT, the prior probability of Russell waiting, and the probability of wait time given Russell is waiting or not waiting. Okay, so the same example, training example set, if you are into learning decision trees, you will make up bunches of decision trees and see which fits this the best. If you are into learning Bayes networks, you make up a bunch of Bayes networks and see which will fit this best. Okay? So to demystify, so actually I will talk about this and this by the time we are done. You know, at least in the next class I'll talk about both of these. Okay? There are many other ways of representing. You can represent it as neural networks, you can represent it as association rules, but ultimately you decide a representation and you see how to convert the training examples into a pattern test in that representation. Okay? Now, here is a simple idea for doing this. This basically takes away the entire magic out of learning. And you know, as I keep saying during the course, you will never learn anything where you think there is magic. Even magic doesn't have magic. Right? Magicians do magic because there's no magic there. It's magic for you and me who are bozos who don't know what they're doing. Okay? So here is a way to do learning, which is figure out a whole bunch of hypotheses, the space of hypotheses. So if you are into decision trees, make up a whole bunch of decision trees and compare it to the training examples and see if the decision tree is correctly classifying the training examples. Pick the decision tree that is classifying the training examples the best. Right? Okay? And if it is similarly, if you are learning Bayes networks, generate a whole bunch of Bayes networks, which is a little harder, but you know, generate a bunch of Bayes networks and see which of them fits the data the best, training data the best, and pick the one that fits the data the best. Okay, now here's my question. It's a simple idea. How many decision trees can there be if you have let's say n Boolean features? If I have n Boolean features, how many decision trees can there be? it turns out that a decision tree is any propositional function. Any propositional function. Okay? If you have n Boolean features, there are 2 power n rows for the function. 2 power n rows for the function. And then there is a column saying answer for the function. That can be true or false. So that if you change this configuration, then the function changes. So there are 2 power n hypothesis. So it's a very simple idea. Just get 2 power n decision trees and compare them to the examples and see which is the best. And that's your brute force idea. And don't mark it, because before this you didn't even have that idea. Now the only problem is that if there are 6 features, if there are 6 Boolean features, this is the number of decision trees. You know that 2 power n, you know, I said 2 power n is the devil or the monster that you should wake up sweating. 2 power n, you should have a heart attack and die. There's no point in waking up. You know, for 6 features, this is the number of decision trees. And you want to do this? Good luck for you. Very simple idea, but you're not going to go anywhere. So you need to start looking for shortcuts. Now one idea would be, just take 1,000 of these decision trees. Just take the 1,000 of these decision trees and see which of these are the best. So I have decided upfront, I am biased. I am thinking that Russell is going to make his decision either based on the restaurant type or based on the number of people waiting, nothing else. So that will cut down the number of hypotheses I will use. And then I'll see which of them fits the best. If I do that, what would you say I have? I have a bias. I am biased. Is bias a good thing or a bad thing? It's a good thing, because I lived, right? When was the last time I mentioned bias? For those of you who actually came to all the classes, there was a time I mentioned bias and how it's so important for living. Nah, that's fine, but there was a Gaugai hypothesis. Do you remember Gaugai hypothesis? So you're standing in some African nation at the edge of a field, and some, you know, hair-like thing just runs in front of you. And the Maasai behind you says, Gaugai. So the question is, what is Gaugai? Okay, is the whole thing of you standing with Maasai behind you and this guy going from right to left Gaugai? Are the thing that's moving Gaugai? Are the field Gaugai? Are your right hand Gaugai? Are you have a fly on your head and he's saying get rid of it? That's Gaugai. What is Gaugai? And you could say, I will make up my mind. Let me first wait. And I mentioned that a kid who tries to learn the concept of bus, when a parent shows bus and says, no, I haven't seen enough examples, let me wait to really figure out what my parents are telling me about bus, would be an ex-kid pretty soon, because they would be run over by buses, right? And they quickly jump to conclusions, because they say whole object. If they show something, then that must basically refer to the whole object. Okay? That's a bias. And by the way, did I ever tell you that Russell actually is making decisions based on decision trees, R Bayes networks, R neural networks, R association network, association rules? No. If you are a guy with a huge big hammer, everything looks like a nail, including your head. Right? So if I feel like, if I am biased into looking for decision trees, I'll find them everywhere. If I am biased into looking for Bayes networks, I will look for them everywhere. So you could use biases. In fact, each representation is a bias in the learning. And for each bias, you can provide the most efficient algorithm that will learn the best hypothesis with respect to that bias. Okay? Now, if my bias is too strong, there may not be, the optimal hypothesis may not even be present in that space. Think about Earth-centric models of planetary system. People tried many, many different Earth-centric models of planetary system. They said, we don't really care where Saturn is, where Sun is, as long as Earth is in the middle, we consider that hypothesis. And they kept changing, better and better hypothesis. And they did improve accuracy, but their accuracy was nowhere to be compared to heliocentric hypothesis. And when we shifted to that bias, you know, which is a more inclusive set of hypotheses, we got a much better idea. Now, you could say you guys are such bozos, all our ancestors are bozos, and they should have looked at the right thing the first time. They're not any more of a bozos than us. We all try to, for computational reasons, reduce the number of hypotheses we consider. Okay? The last thing I want to tell you is, suppose I told you that instead of all Boolean functions, I'm only considering conjunctive Boolean functions. I'll go ahead and decide that whatever this function is, it would be writable as A and B and not C, for example, something like that. Just conjunctive Boolean functions. How many conjunctive Boolean functions are there? First of all, conjunctive Boolean functions is a subset of all Boolean functions, right? How many conjunctive Boolean functions are there for n Boolean variables? What? What? Yes. 3 power n. Now, in no other class in the world would you see 3 power n and say, what a nice number, right? But compared to 2 power n, 3 power n is something that you feel like hugging, right? It turns out that the complexity of learning is proportional to the log of the size of the hypothesis space for discrete hypothesis. Okay? Right? That means, now what is complexity of learning? How many examples do you need to learn the concept? Okay? Complexity of learning is proportional to log of the size of the hypothesis space. So if you have to learn all possible Boolean functions, log of 2 power n is 2 power n. That means it's an exponential learning task. If on the other hand you go ahead and say, I'm only going to look for conjunctive Boolean functions, that is the best fit. It may or may not be real, but that's what I'm going to look for. Then all of a sudden it's log of 3 power n, which is basically n. So you look for conjunctive Boolean functions, not because your uncle told you there are only conjunctive Boolean functions, but that's because that's the easier thing to look for. Why do psychologists or economists, when they're given some data, say, yeah, oh, that's a nice straight line right there? Because they know how to draw straight lines. Okay, any other curve, if you consider all possible families of curves and look for the best curve that will fit the data, too many hypotheses. So you look for lines, okay, and you look for conjunctive functions. Okay, when we come back next class, I'll tell you a way of learning decision trees and a way of learning Bayes networks when you assume that network has this structure, which is naive Bayes cluster.